the villainous Textus Receptus. So many alterations on good manuscript authority made things clear not in a vulgar, notional way, but by giving a deeper and fuller meaning. Think of that vile Textus Receptus leaning entirely on late manuscripts. It is a blessing there are such early ones. Only a couple of years later, Westcott and Hort had decided to edit a new edition of the New Testament. In another letter to Ellerton on April 19, 1853, Hort relates, "I have not seen anybody that I know except Westcott, whom I visited for a few hours. One result of our talk I may as well tell you. He and I are going to edit a Greek text of the New Testament some 2 or 3 years hence, if possible. Lachmann and Tischendorf will supply rich materials, but not nearly enough. Our object is to supply clergymen, generally, schools, etc., with a portable Greek Testament, which shall not be disfigured with Byzantine, that is, medieval, corruptions." Hort's sanguine expectation that this edition would not take long to produce is still in evidence in November of that year, when he indicates that he hopes Westcott and he can crank out their edition in little more than a year. As soon as work began on the project, however, the hopes for a quick turnaround faded. Some 9 years later, Hort, in a letter written to bolster up Westcott, whose spirits were flagging with the prospect of what still lay ahead, urged, "The work has to be done, and never can be done satisfactorily, without vast labor, a fact of which hardly anybody in Europe except ourselves seems conscious. For a great mass of the readings, if we separate them in thought from the rest, the labor is wholly disproportionate. But believing it to be absolutely impossible to draw a line between important and unimportant readings, I should hesitate to say the entire labor is disproportionate to the worth of fixing the entire text to the utmost extent now practicable. It would, I think, be utterly unpardonable for us to give up our task." They were not to give up the task, but it became more intricate and involved as time passed. In the end, it took the two Cambridge scholars 28 years of almost constant work to produce their text, along with an introduction that came from the pen of Hort. The work was well worth it. The Greek text that Westcott and Hort produced is remarkably similar to the one still widely used by scholars today, more than a century later. It's not that no new manuscripts have been discovered, or that no theoretical advances have been made, or that no differences of opinion have emerged since Westcott and Hort's day. Yet even with our advances in technology and methodology, even with the incomparably greater manuscript resources at our disposal, our Greek texts of today bear an uncanny resemblance to the Greek text of Westcott and Hort. It would not serve my purpose here to enter a detailed discussion of the methodological advances that Westcott and Hort made in establishing the text of the Greek New Testament. The area in which their work has perhaps proved most significant is in the grouping of manuscripts. Since Bengel had first recognized that manuscripts could be gathered together in family groupings, somewhat like drawing up genealogies of family members, scholars had attempted to isolate various groups of witnesses into families. Westcott and Hort were very much involved in this endeavor as well. Their view of the matter was based on the principle that manuscripts belong in the same family line whenever they agree with one another in their wording. That is, if two manuscripts have the same wording of a verse, it must be because the two manuscripts ultimately go back to the same source, either the original manuscript or a copy of it. As the principle is sometimes stated, identity of reading implies identity of origin. One can then establish family groups based on textual agreements among the various surviving manuscripts. For Westcott and Hort, there were 4 major families of witnesses, 1. The Syrian text, what other scholars have called the Byzantine text, which comprises most of the late medieval manuscripts. These are numerous but not particularly close in wording to the original text. 2. The Western text, made up of manuscripts that could be dated very early. The archetypes must have been around sometime in the 2nd century at the latest. These manuscripts, however, embody the wild copying practices of scribes in that period before the transcription of texts had become the business of professionals. 3. The Alexandrian text, which was derived from Alexandria, where the scribes were trained and careful but occasionally altered their texts to make them grammatically and stylistically more acceptable, thereby changing the wording of the originals. And 4, the neutral text, which consisted of manuscripts that hadn't undergone any serious change or revision in the course of their transmission, but represented most accurately the texts of the originals. The two leading witnesses of this neutral text, in Westcott and Hort's opinion, were Codex Sinaiticus, the manuscript discovered by Tischendorf, and even more so, Codex Vaticanus, discovered in the Vatican Library. These were the two oldest manuscripts available to Westcott and Hort, and in their judgment they were far superior to any other manuscripts because they represented the so-called neutral text. Many things have changed in nomenclature since Westcott and Hort's day. Scholars no longer talk about a neutral text, and most realize that Western text is a misnomer, since wild copying practices were found in the East as well in the West. Moreover, Westcott and Hort's system has been overhauled by subsequent scholars. Most modern scholars, for example, think that the neutral and Alexandrian text are the same. It's just that some manuscripts are better representatives of this text than are others. Then, too, significant manuscript discoveries, especially discoveries of papyri, have been made since their day. Even so, Westcott and Hort's basic methodology continues to play a role for scholars trying to decide where in our surviving manuscripts we have later alterations and where we can find the earliest stage of the text. As we'll see in the next chapter, this basic methodology is relatively simple to understand once it's laid out clearly. Applying it to textual problems can be interesting and even entertaining as we work to see which variant readings in our manuscripts represent the words of the text as produced by their authors and which represent changes made by later scribes. Chapter 5. Originals That Matter. In this chapter, we'll examine the methods that scholars have devised to identify the original form of the text, or at least the oldest attainable form, and the form of the text that represents a later scribal alteration. After laying out these methods, I will illustrate how they can be used by focusing on three textual variants found in our manuscript tradition of the New Testament. I have chosen these three because each of them is critical for interpreting the book it is in. What's more, none of these variant readings is reflected in most of our modern English translations of the New Testament. That's to say, in my judgment, the translations available to most English readers are based on the wrong text. And having the wrong text makes a real difference for the interpretation of these books. First, however, we should consider the methods scholars have developed for making decisions about which textual readings are original and which represent later changes made by scribes. As we'll see, establishing the earliest form of the text isn't always a simple matter. It can be a demanding exercise. Modern methods of textual criticism. The majority of textual critics today would call themselves rational eclecticists when it comes to making decisions about the oldest form of the text. This means that they choose the root meaning of eclectic from among a variety of textual readings, the one that best represents the oldest form of the text, using a range of rational textual arguments. These arguments are based on evidence that's usually classified as either external or internal in nature. External evidence. Arguments based on external evidence have to do with the surviving manuscript's support for one reading or another. Which manuscripts attest the reading? Are those manuscripts reliable? Why are they reliable or not reliable? In thinking about the manuscripts supporting one textual variant over another, one might be tempted simply to count noses, so to speak, in order to see which variant reading is found in the most surviving witnesses. Most scholars today, however, are not at all convinced that the majority of manuscripts necessarily provide the best available text. The reason for this is easy to explain by way of an illustration. Suppose that after the original manuscript of a text was produced, two copies were made of it, which we may call A and B. These two copies, of course, will differ from each other in some ways, possibly major and probably minor. Now, suppose that A was copied by one other scribe and B was copied by 50 scribes. Then the original manuscript, along with copies A and B, were lost, so that all that remains in the textual tradition are the 51 second-generation copies, one made from A and 50 made from B. If a reading found in the 50 manuscripts from B differs from a reading found in the one from A, is the former necessarily more likely to be the original reading? No, not at all. Even though by counting noses, it's found in 50 times as many witnesses. In fact, the ultimate difference in support for that reading is not 50 manuscripts to one. It's a difference of 1 to 1, A against B. The mere question of numbers of manuscripts supporting one reading over another, therefore, is not particularly germane to the question of which reading in our surviving manuscripts represents the original or oldest form of the text. Scholars are by and large convinced, therefore, that other considerations are far more important in determining which reading is best considered the oldest form of the text. One other consideration is the age of the manuscripts that support a reading. It's far more likely that the oldest form of the text will be found in the oldest surviving manuscripts, on the premise that the text gets changed more frequently with the passing of time. This is not to say that one can blindly follow the oldest manuscripts in every instance, of course. This is for two reasons. The one, a matter of logic, and the other, a matter of history. In terms of logic, suppose a manuscript of the 5th century has one reading, but a manuscript of the 8th century has a different one. Is the reading found in the 5th century manuscript necessarily the older form of the text? No, not necessarily. What if the 5th century manuscript had been produced from a copy of the 4th century, but the 8th century manuscript had been produced from one of the 3rd century? In that case, the 8th century manuscript would preserve the older reading. The second historical reason that one cannot simply look at what the oldest manuscript reads with no other considerations is that, as we've seen, the earliest period of textual transmission was also the least controlled. This is when non-professional scribes, for the most part, were copying our texts and making lots of mistakes in their copies. And so, age does matter, but it cannot be an absolute criterion. This is why most textual critics are rational eclecticists. They believe that they have to look at a range of arguments for one reading or another, not simply count the manuscripts or consider only the verifiably oldest ones. Still, at the end of the day, If the majority of our earliest manuscripts support one reading over another, surely that combination of factors should be seen as carrying some weight in making a textual decision. Another feature of the external evidence is the geographical range of manuscripts in support of one reading over another. Suppose a reading's found in a number of manuscripts, but all these manuscripts can be shown to have originated, say, in Rome, whereas a wide range of other manuscripts from, say, Egypt, Palestine, Asia Minor, and Gaul all represent some other reading. In that case, the textual critic might suspect that the one reading was a local variant, the copies in Rome all having the same mistake, and that the other reading is the one that's older and more likely to preserve the original text. Probably the most important external criterion that scholars follow is this. For a reading to be considered original, it normally should be found in the best manuscripts and the best groups of manuscripts. This is a rather tricky assessment, but it works this way. Some manuscripts can be shown, on a variety of grounds, to be superior to others. For example, whenever internal evidence, discuss next, is virtually decisive for a reading, these manuscripts almost always have that reading, whereas other manuscripts, usually as it turns out, the later manuscripts, have the alternative reading. The principle involved here states that if some manuscripts are known to be superior in readings when the oldest form is obvious, they are more likely to be superior also in readings for which internal evidence is not as clear. In a way, it's like having witnesses in a court of law or knowing friends whose word you can trust. When you know that a person is prone to lying, then you can never be sure that he or she is to be trusted. But if you know that a person is completely reliable, then you can trust that person even when he or she is telling you something you can't otherwise verify. The same applies to groups of witnesses. We saw in Chapter 4 that Westcott and Hort developed Bengel's idea that manuscripts could be grouped into textual families. Some of these textual groupings, as it turns out, are more to be trusted than others, in that they preserve the oldest and best of our surviving witnesses and, when tested, are shown to provide superior readings. In particular, most rational eclecticists think that the so-called Alexandrian text, this includes Hort's neutral text, originally associated with the careful copying practices of the Christian scribes in Alexandria, Egypt, is the superior form of text available and in most cases provides us with the oldest or original text wherever there is variation. The Byzantine and Western texts, on the other hand, are less likely to preserve the best readings when they are not also supported by Alexandrian manuscripts. Internal evidence. Textual critics who consider themselves rational eclecticists choose from a range of readings based on a number of pieces of evidence. In addition to the external evidence provided by the manuscripts, two kinds of internal evidence are typically used. The first involves what are called intrinsic probabilities. Probabilities based on what the author of the text was himself most likely to have written. We are able to study, of course, the writing style, the vocabulary, and the theology of an author. When two or more variant readings are preserved among our manuscripts, and one of them uses words or stylistic features otherwise not found in that author's work, or if it represents a point of view that's at variance with what the author otherwise embraces, then it's unlikely that that is what the author wrote, especially if another attested reading coincides perfectly well with the author's writing elsewhere. The second kind of internal evidence is called transcriptional probability. This asks not which reading an author was likely to have written, but which reading a scribe was likely to have created. Ultimately, this kind of evidence goes back to Bengel's idea that the more difficult reading is more likely to be original. This is premised on the idea that scribes are more likely to try to correct what they take to be mistakes, to harmonize passages that they regard as contradictory, and to bring the theology of a text more into line with their own theology. Readings that might seem on the surface to contain a mistake or lack of harmony or peculiar theology are therefore more likely to have been changed by a scribe than are easier readings. This criterion is sometimes expressed as the reading that best explains the existence of the others is more likely to be original. I've been laying out the various external and internal forms of evidence that textual critics consider, not because I expect everyone reading these pages to master these principles and start applying them to the manuscript tradition of the New Testament, but because it's important to recognize that when we try to decide what the original text was, a range of considerations must be taken into account and a lot of judgment calls have to be made. There are times when the various pieces of evidence are at odds with one another. For example, when the more difficult reading, transcriptional probabilities, is not well attested in the early manuscripts, external evidence. Or when the more difficult reading does not coincide with the writing style of the author otherwise, intrinsic probabilities. In short, determining the original text is neither simple nor straightforward. It requires a lot of thought and careful sifting of the evidence, and different scholars invariably come to different conclusions, not only about minor matters that have no bearing on the meaning of a passage, such as the spelling of a word or a change of word order in Greek that can't even be replicated in English translation, but also about matters of major importance, matters that affect the interpretation of an entire book of the New Testament. To illustrate the importance of some textual decisions, I turn now to three textual variants of the latter sort, where the determination of the original text has a significant bearing on how one understands the message of some of the New Testament authors. As it turns out, in each of these cases, I think most English translators have chosen the wrong reading, and so present a translation not of the original text, but of the text that scribes created when they altered the original. The first of these texts comes from Mark and has to do with Jesus becoming angry when a poor leper pleads with him to be healed. Mark and an angry Jesus. The textual problem of Mark chapter 1, verse 41, occurs in the story of Jesus healing a man with a skin disease. The surviving manuscripts preserve verse 41 in two different forms. Both readings are shown here. And he came preaching in their synagogues in all of Galilee and casting out the demons. And a leper came to him, beseeching him and saying to him, "If you wish, you are able to cleanse me." And, feeling compassion, in Greek, splonisthes, becoming angry, in Greek, orgisthes, reaching out his hand, he touched him and said, "I wish, be cleansed." And immediately the leprosy went out from him and he was cleansed. And rebuking him severely, immediately he cast him out and said to him, "See that you say nothing to anyone, but go, show yourself to the priest, and offer for your cleansing that which Moses commanded as a witness to them." But when he went out, he began to preach many things and to spread the word, so that he, Jesus, was no longer able to enter publicly into a city. Most English translations render the beginning of verse 41 so as to emphasize Jesus' love for this poor outcast leper. Feeling compassion, or the word could be translated moved with pity for him. In doing so, these translations are following the Greek text found in most of our manuscripts. It's certainly easy to see why compassion might be called for in the situation. We don't know the precise nature of the man's disease. Many commentators prefer to think of it as a scaly skin disorder rather than the kind of rotting flesh that we commonly associate with leprosy. In any event, he may well have fallen under the injunctions of the Torah that forbade lepers of any sort to live normal lives. They were to be isolated, cut off from the public, considered unclean, Leviticus chapters 13 to 14. Moved with pity for such a one, Jesus reaches out a tender hand, touches his diseased flesh, and heals him. The simple pathos and unproblematic emotion of the scene may well account for translators and interpreters, as a rule, not considering the alternative text found in some of our manuscripts. For the wording of one of our oldest witnesses, called Codex Bezi, which is supported by three Latin manuscripts, is at first puzzling and wrenching. Here, rather than saying that Jesus felt compassion for the man, the text indicates that he became angry. In Greek, it's the difference between the words splognisthes and orgisthes. Because of its attestation in both Greek and Latin witnesses, this other reading is generally conceded by textual specialists to go back at least to the second century. Is it possible, though, that this is what Mark himself wrote? As we've already seen, we're never completely safe in saying that when the vast majority of manuscripts have one reading and only a couple have another, the majority are right. Sometimes a few manuscripts appear to be right even when all the others disagree. In part, this is because the vast majority of our manuscripts were produced hundreds and hundreds of years after the originals, and they themselves were copied not from the originals but from other, much later copies. Once a change made its way into the manuscript tradition, it could be perpetuated until it became more commonly transmitted than the original wording. In this case, both readings we're considering appear to be very ancient. Which one is original? If Christian readers today were given the choice between these two readings, no doubt almost everyone would choose the one more commonly attested in our manuscripts. Jesus felt pity for this man, and so he healed him. The other reading is hard to figure out. What would it mean to say that Jesus felt angry? Isn't this in itself sufficient ground for assuming that Mark must have written that Jesus felt compassion? On the contrary, the fact that one of the readings makes such good sense and is easy to understand is precisely what makes some scholars suspect that it's wrong. For as we've seen, scribes also would have preferred the text to be non-problematic and simple to understand. The question to be asked is this: which is more likely, that a scribe copying this text would change it to say that Jesus became wrathful instead of compassionate, or to say that Jesus became compassionate instead of wrathful? Which reading better explains the existence of the other? When seen from this perspective, the latter is obviously more likely. The reading that indicates Jesus became angry is the more difficult reading and therefore more likely to be original. There's even better evidence than this speculative question of which reading the scribes were more likely to invent. As it turns out, we don't have any Greek manuscripts of Mark that contain this passage until the end of the 4th century, nearly 300 years after the book was produced. But we do have two authors who copied this story within 20 years of its first production. Scholars have long recognized that Mark was the first gospel to be written, and that both Matthew and Luke used Mark's account as a source for their own stories about Jesus. It's possible, then, to examine Matthew and Luke to see how they changed Mark, wherever they tell the same story, but in a more or less different way. When we do this, we find that Matthew and Luke have both taken over this story from Mark, their common source. It's striking that Matthew and Luke are almost word for word the same as Mark in the leper's request and in Jesus' response in verses 40 to 41. Which word, then, do they use to describe Jesus' reaction? Does he become compassionate or angry? Oddly enough, Matthew and Luke both omit the word altogether. If the text of Mark available to Matthew and Luke had described Jesus as feeling compassion, why would each of them have omitted the word? Both Matthew and Luke describe Jesus as compassionate elsewhere, and whenever Mark has a story in which Jesus' compassion is explicitly mentioned, one or the other of them retains this description in his own account. What about the other option? What if both Matthew and Luke read in Mark's gospel that Jesus became angry? Would they have been inclined to eliminate that emotion? There are, in fact, other occasions on which Jesus becomes angry in Mark. In each instance, Matthew and Luke have modified the accounts. In Mark chapter 3, verse 5, Jesus looks around with anger at those in the synagogue who are watching to see if he will heal the man with the withered hand. Luke has the verse almost the same as Mark, but he removes the reference to Jesus' anger. Matthew completely rewrites this section of the story and says nothing of Jesus' wrath. Similarly, in Mark chapter 10, verse 14, Jesus is aggravated at his disciples, a different Greek word is used, for not allowing people to bring their children to be blessed. Both Matthew and Luke have the story, often verbally the same, but both delete the reference to Jesus' anger. Matthew chapter 19, verse 14, Luke chapter 18, verse 16. In sum, Matthew and Luke have no qualms about describing Jesus as compassionate, but they never describe him as angry. Whenever one of their sources, Mark, did so, they both independently rewrote the term out of their stories. Thus, whereas it's difficult to understand why they would have removed feeling compassion from the account of Jesus' healing of the leper, it's altogether easy to see why they might have wanted to remove feeling anger. Combined with the circumstance that the latter term is attested in a very ancient stream of our manuscript tradition, and that scribes would have been unlikely to create it out of the much more readily comprehensible feeling compassion, it's becoming increasingly evident that Mark, in fact, described Jesus as angry when approached by the lepers to be healed. One other point must be emphasized before we move on. I've indicated that whereas Matthew and Luke have difficulty ascribing anger to Jesus, Mark has no problem doing so. Even in the story under consideration, apart from the textual problem of verse 41, Jesus does not treat this poor leper with kid gloves. After he heals him, he severely rebukes him and throws him out. These are literal renderings of the Greek words, which are usually softened in translation. They are harsh terms used elsewhere in Mark, always in context of violent conflict and aggression. For example, when Jesus casts out demons. It's difficult to see why Jesus would harshly upbraid this person and cast him out if he feels compassion for him. But if he's angry, perhaps it makes better sense. At what, though, would Jesus be angry? This is where the relationship of text and interpretation becomes critical. Some scholars who have preferred the text that indicates that Jesus became angry in this passage have come up with highly improbable interpretations. Their goal in doing so appears to be to exonerate the emotion by making Jesus look compassionate, even though they realize that the text says he becomes angry. One commentator, for example, argues that Jesus is angry with the state of the world that is full of disease. In other words, he loves the sick but hates the sickness. There's no textual basis for the interpretation, but it does have the virtue of making Jesus look good. Another interpreter argues that Jesus is angry because this leprous person had been alienated from society, overlooking the facts that the text says nothing about the man being an outsider, and even if he assumes he was, it wouldn't have been the fault of Jesus' society, but of the law of God, specifically the book of Leviticus. Another argues that, in fact, that is what Jesus was angry about, that the law of Moses forces this kind of alienation. This interpretation ignores the fact that at the conclusion of the passage, verse 44 Jesus affirms the law of Moses and urges the former leper to observe it. All these interpretations have in common the desire to exonerate Jesus' anger and the decision to bypass the text in order to do so. Should we opt to do otherwise? What might we conclude? It seems to me that there are two options. One that focuses on the immediate literary context of the passage, and the other on its broader context. First, in terms of the more immediate context, how is one struck by the portrayal of Jesus in the opening part of Mark's Gospel? Bracketing for a moment our own preconceptions of who Jesus was and simply reading this particular text, we have to admit that Jesus does not come off as the meek and mild, soft-featured, good shepherd of the stained glass window. Mark begins his gospel by portraying Jesus as a physically and charismatically powerful authority figure who is not to be messed with. He's introduced by a wild man prophet in the wilderness. He's cast out from society to do battle in the wilderness with Satan and the wild beasts. He returns to call for urgent repentance in the face of the imminent coming of God's judgment. He rips his followers away from their families. He overwhelms his audiences with his authority. He rebukes and overpowers demonic forces that can completely subdue mere mortals. He refuses to accede to popular demand, ignoring people who plead for an audience with him. The only story in this opening chapter of Mark that hints at personal compassion is the healing of Simon Peter's mother-in-law, sick in bed. But even that compassionate interpretation may be open to question. Some wry observers have noted that after Jesus dispels her fever, she rises to serve them, presumably bringing them their evening meal. Is it possible that Jesus is being portrayed in the opening scenes of Mark's gospel as a powerful figure with a strong will and an agenda of his own, a charismatic authority who doesn't like to be disturbed? It would certainly make sense of his response to the healed leper, whom he harshly rebukes and then casts out. There's another explanation, though. As I've indicated, Jesus does get angry elsewhere in Mark's gospel. The next time it happens is in chapter 3, which involves, strikingly, another healing story. Here, Jesus is explicitly said to be angry at Pharisees, who think that he has no authority to heal the man with the crippled hand on the Sabbath. In some ways, an even closer parallel comes in a story in which Jesus' anger is not explicitly mentioned, but is nonetheless evident. In Mark chapter 9, when Jesus comes down from the Mount of Transfiguration with Peter, James, and John, he finds a crowd around his disciples and a desperate man in their midst. The man's son is possessed by a demon, and he explains the situation to Jesus and then appeals to him. If you are able, have pity on us and help us. Jesus fires back an angry response. If you are able, everything is possible to the one who believes. The man grows even more desperate and pleads, I believe, help my unbelief. Jesus then casts out the demon. What's striking in these stories is that Jesus' evident anger erupts when someone doubts his willingness, ability, or divine authority to heal. Maybe this is what's involved in the story of the leper as well. As in the story of Mark chapter 9, someone approaches Jesus gingerly to ask, If you are willing, you are able to heal me. Jesus becomes angry. Of course he's willing, just as he is able and authorized. He heals the man and, still somewhat miffed, rebukes him sharply and throws him out. There's a completely different feel to the story, given this way of construing it, a construal based on the text as Mark appears to have written it. Mark, in places, portrays an angry Jesus. Luke, and an imperturbable Jesus. Unlike Mark, The Gospel of Luke never explicitly states that Jesus becomes angry. In fact, here Jesus never appears to become disturbed at all in any way. Rather than an angry Jesus, Luke portrays an imperturbable Jesus. There's only one passage in this gospel in which Jesus appears to lose his composure, and that, interestingly enough, is in a passage whose authenticity is hotly debated among textual scholars. The passage occurs in the context of Jesus' prayer on the Mount of Olives just before he's betrayed and arrested. Luke chapter 22, verses 39 to 46. After enjoining his disciples to pray lest you enter into temptation, Jesus leaves them, bows to his knees, and prays, "Father, if it be your will, remove this cup from me. Accept not my will, but yours be done." In a large number of manuscripts, the prayer is followed by the account, found nowhere else among our Gospels, of Jesus' heightened agony and so-called bloody sweat. "And an angel from heaven appeared to him, strengthening him. And being in agony, he began to pray yet more fervently, and his sweat became like drops of blood falling to the ground." Verses 43 to 44. The scene closes with Jesus rising from prayer and returning to his disciples to find them asleep. He then repeats his initial injunction for them to pray, lest you enter into temptation. Immediately, Judas arrives with the crowds, and Jesus is arrested. One of the intriguing features of the debate about this passage is the balance of arguments back and forth over whether the disputed verses, verses 43 to 44, were written by Luke or were instead inserted by a later scribe. The manuscripts that are known to be earliest and that are generally conceded to be the best, the Alexandrian text, do not, as a rule, include the verses. So perhaps they are a later scribal addition. On the other hand, the verses are found in several other early witnesses and are, on the whole, widely distributed throughout the entire manuscript tradition. So were they added by scribes who wanted them in, or deleted by scribes who wanted them out? It's difficult to say on the basis of the manuscripts themselves. Some scholars have proposed that we consider other features of the verses to help us decide. One scholar, for example, has claimed that the vocabulary and style of the verses are very much like what's found in Luke otherwise. This is an argument based on intrinsic probabilities. For example, appearances of angels are common in Luke, and several words and phrases found in the passage occur in other places in Luke, but nowhere else in the New Testament, such as the verb for strengthen. The argument hasn't proved convincing to everyone, however, since most of these characteristically Lucan ideas, constructions, and phrases are either formulated in uncharacteristically Lucan ways, for example, angels never appear elsewhere in Luke without speaking, or are common in Jewish and Christian texts outside the New Testament. Moreover, there's an inordinately high concentration of unusual words and phrases in these verses. For example, three of the key words, agony, sweat, and drops, occur nowhere else in Luke, nor are they found in Acts, the second volume that the same author wrote. At the end of the day, it's difficult to decide about these verses on the basis of their vocabulary and style. Another argument scholars have used has to do with the literary structure of the passage. In a nutshell, the passage appears to be deliberately structured as what scholars have called a chiasmus. When a passage is chiastically structured, the first statement of the passage corresponds to the last one. The second statement corresponds to the second to last, the third to last, and so on. In other words, this is an intentional design. Its purpose is to focus attention on the center of the passage as its key. And so here, Jesus, A, tells his disciples to pray lest you enter into temptation, verse 40. He then B, leaves them, verse 41a, and C, kneels to pray, verse 41b. The center of the passage is D, Jesus' prayer itself, a prayer bracketed by his two requests that God's will be done, verse 42. Jesus then C, rises from prayer, verse 45a, B, returns to his disciples, verse 45b, and A, finding them asleep, once again addresses them in the same words, telling them to pray lest you enter into temptation, verses 45c to 46. The mere presence of this clear literary structure isn't really the point. The point is how the chiasmus contributes to the meaning of the passage. The story begins and ends with the injunction to the disciples to pray so as to avoid entering into temptation. Prayer has long been recognized as an important theme in the Gospel of Luke, more so than in the other Gospels. Here it comes into special prominence. For at the very center of the passage is Jesus' own prayer, a prayer that expresses his desire, bracketed by his greater desire, that the Father's will be done, verses 41c to 42. As the center of the chiastic structure, this prayer supplies the passage's point of focus and correspondingly the key to its interpretation. This is a lesson on the importance of prayer in the face of temptation. The disciples, despite Jesus' repeated request to them to pray, fall asleep instead. Immediately, the crowd comes to arrest Jesus. And what happens? The disciples, who have failed to pray, do enter into temptation. They flee the scene, leaving Jesus to face his fate alone. What about Jesus, the one who has prayed before the coming of his trial? When the crowd arrives, he calmly submits to his Father's will, yielding himself up to the martyrdom that has been prepared for him. Luke's Passion Narrative, as has long been recognized, is a story of Jesus' martyrdom, a martyrdom that functions, as do many others, to set an example to the faithful of how to remain firm in the face of death. Luke's martyrology shows that only prayer can prepare one to die. What happens, though, when the disputed verses, verses 43 to 44, are injected into the passage? On the literary level, the chiasmus that focuses the passage on Jesus' prayer is absolutely destroyed. Now the center of the passage, and hence its focus, shifts to Jesus' agony, an agony so terrible as to require a supernatural comforter for strength to bear it. It's significant that in this longer version of the story, Jesus' prayer does not produce the calm assurance that he exudes throughout the rest of the account. Indeed, it's only after he prays yet more fervently that his sweat takes on the appearance of great drops of blood falling to the ground. My point isn't simply that a nice literary structure has been lost, but that the entire focus of attention shifts to Jesus in deep and heart-rending agony and in need of miraculous intervention. This in itself may not seem like an insurmountable problem until one realizes that nowhere else in Luke's gospel is Jesus portrayed in this way. Quite the contrary, Luke has gone to great lengths to counter precisely the view of Jesus that these verses embrace. Rather than entering his passion with fear and trembling, in anguish over his coming fate, the Jesus of Luke goes to his death calm and in control, confident of his Father's will until the very end. It's a striking fact, of particular relevance to our textual problem, that Luke could produce this image of Jesus only by eliminating traditions that contradicted it from his sources, for example, the Gospel according to Mark. Only the longer text of Luke chapter 23, verses 43 to 44, stands out as anomalous. A simple comparison with Mark's version of the story at hand is instructive in this regard. Understanding that Mark was Luke's source, which he changed to create his own distinctive emphasis. For Luke has completely omitted Mark's statement that Jesus began to be distressed and agitated, Mark chapter 14, verse 33, as well as Jesus' own comment to his disciples, "My soul is deeply troubled, even unto death," Mark chapter 14, verse 34. Rather than falling to the ground in anguish, Mark chapter 14, verse 35, Luke's Jesus bows to his knees, Luke chapter 22, verse 41. In Luke, Jesus does not ask that the hour might pass from him, see Mark chapter 14, verse 35, and rather than praying three times for the cup to be removed, Mark chapter 14, verse 36, verse 39, and 41, he asks only once, Luke chapter 22, verse 42, prefacing his prayer only in Luke with the important condition, "If it be your will." And so, while Luke's source, the Gospel of Mark, portrays Jesus in anguish as he prays in the garden, Luke has completely remodeled the scene to show Jesus at peace in the face of death. The only exception is the account of Jesus' bloody sweat, an account absent from our earliest and best witnesses. Why would Luke have gone to such lengths to eliminate Mark's portrayal of an anguished Jesus, if in fact Jesus' anguish were the point of his story? It's clear that Luke does not share Mark's understanding that Jesus was in anguish, bordering on despair. Nowhere is this more evident than in their subsequent accounts of Jesus' crucifixion. Mark portrays Jesus as silent on his path to Golgotha. His disciples have fled. Even the faithful women look on only from a distance. All those present deride him, passers-by, Jewish leaders, and both robbers. Mark's Jesus has been beaten, mocked, deserted, and forsaken, not just by his followers, but finally by God himself. His only words in the entire proceeding come at the very end, when he cries aloud, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani? My God, why have you forsaken me?" He then utters a loud cry and dies. This portrayal again stands in sharp contrast to what we find in Luke. In Luke's account, Jesus is far from silent. And when he speaks, he shows that he's still in control, trustful of God his Father, confident of his fate, concerned for the fate of others. En route to his crucifixion, according to Luke, when Jesus sees a group of women bewailing his misfortune, he tells them not to weep for him, but for themselves and their children, because of the disaster that is soon to befall them. Chapter 23, verses 27 to 31. While being nailed to the cross, rather than being silent, he prays to God, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they are doing." Chapter 23, verse 34. On the cross, in the throes of his passion, Jesus engages in an intelligent conversation with one of the robbers crucified beside him, assuring him that they will be together that day in paradise. Chapter 23, verse 43. Most telling of all, rather than uttering his pathetic cry of dereliction at the end, Luke's Jesus, in full confidence of his standing before God, commends his soul to his loving Father. "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." Chapter 24, verse 46. It would be difficult to overestimate the significance of these changes that Luke made in his source, Mark, for understanding our textual problem. At no point in Luke's passion narrative does Jesus lose control. Never is he in deep and debilitating anguish over his fate. He is in charge of his own destiny, knowing what he must do and what will happen to him once he does it. This is a man who is at peace with himself and tranquil in the face of death. What then shall we say about our disputed verses? These are the only verses in the entire Gospel of Luke that undermine this clear portrayal. Only here does Jesus agonize over his coming fate. Only here does he appear out of control, unable to bear the burden of his destiny. Why would Luke have totally eliminated all remnants of Jesus' agony elsewhere if he meant to emphasize it in yet stronger terms here? Why remove compatible material from his source, both before and after the verses in question? It appears that the account of Jesus' bloody sweat, not found in our earliest and best manuscripts, is not original to Luke, but is a scribal addition to the Gospel. Hebrews and a Forsaken Jesus. Luke's portrayal of Jesus stands in contrast not only to that of Mark, but also to that of other New Testament authors, including the unknown author of the Epistle to the Hebrews, who appears to presuppose knowledge of passion traditions in which Jesus was terrified in the face of death and died with no divine succor or support, as can be seen in the resolution of one of the most interesting textual problems of the New Testament. The problem occurs in a context that describes the eventual subjugation of all things to Jesus, the Son of Man. Again, I have placed in brackets the textual variance in question. For when God, in brackets, subjects to him all things, he leaves nothing that is not subjected to him. But we do not yet see all things subjected to him. But we do see Jesus, who, having been made for a little while lower than the angels, was crowned with glory and honor on account of his suffering of death, so that, bracket, by the grace of God apart from God, bracket, he might taste death for everyone. Hebrews chapter 2, verses 8 to 9. Although almost all the surviving manuscripts state that Jesus died for all people, by the grace of God, kariti theou, a couple of others state instead that he died apart from God, chorus theou. There are good reasons for thinking that the latter, however, was the original reading of the Epistle to the Hebrews. I don't need to go into the intricacies of the manuscript support for the reading apart from God, except to say that even though it occurs in only two documents of the 10th century, one of these, manuscript 1739, is known to have been produced from a copy that was at least as ancient as our earliest manuscripts. Of yet greater interest, the early 3rd century scholar Origen tells us that this was the reading of the majority of manuscripts of his own day. Other evidence also suggests its early popularity. It was found in manuscripts known to Ambrose and Jerome in the Latin West, and it's quoted by a range of church writers down to the 11th century. And so, despite the fact that it's not widely attested among our surviving manuscripts, the reading was at one time supported by strong external evidence. When one turns from external to internal evidence, there can be no doubt concerning the superiority of this poorly attested variant. We've already seen that scribes were far more likely to make a reading that was hard to understand easier, rather than make an easy reading harder. This variant provides a textbook case of the phenomenon. Christians in the early centuries commonly regarded Jesus' death as the supreme manifestation of God's grace. To say, though, that Jesus died apart from God could be taken to mean any number of things, most of them unpalatable. Since scribes must have created one of these readings out of the other, there's little question concerning which of the two is more likely the corruption. But was the alteration deliberate? Advocates of the more commonly attested text, Grace of God, have naturally had to claim that the change wasn't made on purpose, otherwise their favored text would almost certainly be the modification. By virtue of necessity, then, they have devised alternative scenarios to explain the accidental origin of the more difficult reading. Most commonly, it's simply supposed that because the words in question are similar in appearance, kariti theou, a scribe inadvertently mistook the word grace for the preposition apart from. This view, however, seems a shade unlikely. Is a negligent or absent-minded scribe likely to have changed his text by writing a word used less frequently in the New Testament, apart from, or one used more frequently, grace, four times as common? Is he likely to have created a phrase that occurs nowhere else in the New Testament, apart from God, or one that occurs more than 20 times, by the grace of God? Is he likely to have produced a statement, even by accident, that's bizarre and troubling, or one that's familiar and easy?